580.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. My thanks to my colleague Jackie Lyden for filling in for me for the last 2 days so I could attend to a death in the family. This year marks the 50th anniversary of President Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty. And all this year, we've been taking a look at how the face of American poverty is changing. And we've been talking about whether our national conversation about poverty matches the reality. Today, we want to take a look at how African Americans and whites may experience poverty differently, even when they live essentially side by side in the same city. A group of researchers followed hundreds of poor children in Baltimore for more than 25 years and found race, more than substance abuse, education, or criminal history, determined their access to economic opportunity. That research is the centerpiece of the new book, The Long Shadow: Family Background, Disadvantaged Urban Youth, and the Transition to Adulthood. The book's findings are already getting a lot of attention, so we've called Carl Alexander, one of the researchers and a professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University. Professor Alexander, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Also with us for additional perspective is writer Dee Watkins. He's an adjunct professor at Coppin State University, and he's written extensively about growing up poor and black in Baltimore. Professor Watkins, thank you also for joining us.
Thank you. How's everything?
Great. So, Professor Alexander, let me start with you. The study followed 800 children for decades of their lives. It's an unusually long period of study. What were you looking for? What motivated this to begin with?
Well, we refer to the project as the Beginning School Study. The intuition at the time was that if getting off to a bumpy start would not augur well for what follows, and getting off to a smooth transition in first grade would smooth the skids all the way along. And in fact, we did that. But then when we got into it, we realized that we had really set the stage for something that would be more ambitious. And so we decided to stay with it a bit longer.
Now, about 40% of the children you studied were white. The rest were African American. Did you think that race would play a part in your findings from the beginning?
Oh, we absolutely did. The project took a somewhat surprising turn when we looked at some of the information we got from these our study youngsters when they had exited high school at age 22 and 28. One of the things that was so striking in our initial review of our findings was that hardly any of these children who grew up in difficult low-income family circumstances were successful in completing college. So at age 28, the last time we spoke with them, only 4% of the children we call urban disadvantaged had a baccalaureate degree, and even fewer of these youngsters had attained an associate arts degree, a two-year degree. So not many of the urban disadvantaged in the experiences of our youngsters were moving up in life through the mechanisms that we encourage them to focus in on. You know, mm-hmm. Do well at school, play by the rules, do what your teachers tell you, and good things will happen. Well, a lot of them played by the rules and did the right things, but the good things didn't follow.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about different outcomes for poor whites and blacks based on a 25-year study that took place in Baltimore. Our guests are Professor Carl Alexander, one of the researchers in the study, and also Dee Watkins, who's an adjunct professor and also a writer who grew up in Baltimore, which is where the study took place. So Dee Watkins, let me hear from you. Did when you were growing up, did you know white people growing up? I think a lot of people have this idea that, you know, people in a lot of urban areas live largely segregated lives. They don't really know anybody who's of a different background or a different race. Did you know white people growing up, and did you see their lives as different from yours?
Housing police and some school teachers. I didn't really know. Like, all of my schools were all black. The people who I know who went to church went to black churches. I've played sports in all black rec centers. I really didn't meet or have any personal relationships with white people until I got into college, other than like a few teachers that were like that I had a connection with coming up.
Do you remember ever wondering about white people or whether their lives were different from yours?
You know, you think that, you know, what you get is from, you know, like music and television. So, you know, you think like, well, every white person lives like that show, The Wonder Years. Well, it's not something that I spent a lot of time thinking about as a kid, but, you know, just looking back in retrospect and, you know, then talking about some of the things I write about, the part of Baltimore I grew up in is extremely segregated, and you're not going to come across too many white people coming up.
Well, Professor Alexander, I think one of the points that the study makes very bluntly is that poor white poverty, particularly in an urban area, gets disappeared somehow. right?
Yeah,
just some, why is that, by the way?
Well, that's exactly right. I think if your understanding of what cities like Baltimore is like comes from the media, it's quite clear. You'd think that the issue of urban poverty is an issue of African American poor, but in point of fact, there are pockets of white poverty scattered all throughout Baltimore. Low income whites and low income blacks live substantially segregated lives owing to residential segregation, so they live in parallel. But poor whites are there, and one of the interesting patterns that we observed as we tried to make sense out of the experiences of the youngsters in our study group was that poor white men especially, were much more successful in the labor market, despite not being particularly successful in school. That is, the poor white men had the lowest average level of completed schooling of any of the groups we compared, but they had the highest earnings, and they had the most steady employment over the years after high school.
So everybody who was low income had a hard time accessing higher education. So that was one of the findings.
That's absolutely true.
But poor white men who didn't finish high school had far better employment prospects than poor black men who didn't finish high school. Why is that?
The key to this difference is access to high pay, high skill work in the blue collar workforce. And in the main, it's the remnants of Baltimore's industrial economy is where it stands out in the experiences of these study youngsters. 45% of the white men of working class background at age 28 were employed in the industrial and construction crafts. So they were plumbers, electricians, mechanics, welders, brick masons. People have the idea that with deindustrialization, those kinds of positions have just disappeared from the map. And it's certainly the case that there are fewer jobs of that sort in the industrial economy, in the urban industrial economy. And of those employed in that sector, the whites were earning double what the African American men were earning. So there is a decided pattern of what we call white privilege or white advantage that presents itself in accessing high pay, steady work.
And how did they get those jobs? You asked them, how did you get that job? What did they say?
Well, in fact, we did ask them straight out at age 22. We said, how did you get your current job? And whites much more often said through family and friends, and African Americans much more often said on their own. So we think the story here revolves substantially around social networks that are advantageous for some and lacking for others.
So let me ask Dee Watkins about that. So Dee, how did you... Tell me about when you were growing up, what did you think you were going to be doing when you became a grown-up? Do you remember thinking about it? What did you want to do? What did you think you were going to be doing?
I wanted to play basketball.
So did I.
I
wanted to play basketball, and then I had a doctor phase, I had a lawyer phase. I wanted to be all of these different things, but I ended up outside like everyone else. And it's crazy just listening to this because the things that are in Carl's study, it's the things that everyone says, but, you know, there's always that other side that can argue this and argue that, but he put down the cold hard facts. Like, they put down the cold hard facts. So now, you know, the things that we say are now confirmed through this study and undeniable. You know, I don't know too many people who can say, hey, you know, my uncle has a plumbing company. We'll teach you the trade. We'll bring you in as an apprentice and, you know, we'll help you out, or electricians and things like that. So, no, I wanted to go to college. I wanted to play basketball, but you know, and I started out on that path, and then I just went a different direction.
So, did you know anybody in your life growing up among, as you said, in an African American environment, like really not knowing any white people except for the housing police and teachers, who got a job through relatives?
Yeah, but it's not common.
So, Professor Alexander, we're down to our last, you know, couple of minutes here, and I wanted to hear some. What are the policy implications of this? I mean, how would you like this to inform the way we think about this whole issue now?
You can enforce equal employment opportunity laws and things of that sort, and absolutely we should. But that doesn't speak to the advantages that come through just being in the right place at the right time and knowing the right kinds of people. So I don't have an easy answer, I'm afraid to say. But I think I think we have an understanding of the issue, and perhaps people who do work on policy and they're more clever than I can figure out some approaches.
Okay, Dee Watkins, a final thought from you. Knowing what you know now, about how things work. And I am mindful that I heard you say this was the kind of thing that you always talked about or that you heard about or that was rumored, but that you never really knew was true. Now that you know that the networks do make a difference, do you have any thoughts about what would have made a difference for you?
What I would say is if we all just, you know, from the black side, we just had the ability to reach out and connect more with the other side, and, you know, hopefully the city will be less segregated one day. But even, you know, if it doesn't go in that direction, open up these networks, get some of these trade jobs because they're out there and learn these skills, and just expose young people to more things because, you know, like we talked about, college is just not going to work for everyone.
Do you have time for me to just jump in and add to that?
Because very briefly. Yeah.
So
it
turns out white men have the highest rate in our group, have the highest rates of binge drinking, marijuana use, and heavy drug use, and have arrest records that are comparable to the African American men. So lots of young people in places like Baltimore take a misstep along the way. What's so striking is that white men's employment prospects aren't nearly as impaired by, you know, that profile as our white men, so as our African American men's employment prospects. So if a young African American man gets in trouble with the law or drops out of high school, that really does pose barriers for his getting good access to good paying steady work. For white men, it's not so much the case.
Important information. That was Professor Carl Alexander joining us from the studios at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. Dee Watkins is with us. He's a writer and adjunct professor at Coppin State University. He joined us from member station WYPR in Baltimore. Obviously, there's a lot to talk about here, and so I hope we'll continue to talk about this. Will be the first conversation and not the last conversation. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, a recent opinion piece on Time Magazine's website calls for white gay men to, quote, stop stealing black female culture, unquote. That piece has prompted a social media firestorm with some commentators hitting back. So what if they are? Our pop culture salon is here, and they'll weigh in on that and other hot stories of the week. That's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Miscarriages happen all the time, but for many people, they're still considered a taboo topic.
People don't talk about it when they have miscarriages, and you feel alone. You're going through this grieving, and you feel like you're the only one that's going through it.
We'll continue our look at miscarriages next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
This Week in This American Life, real rules from the real handbooks for professional cheerleaders, like, for example, bread should be torn to eat, not cut with a knife. Do not overeat bread at a formal setting. Avoid starting conversations about the weather, unless the other person brings it up. It seems like a desperate attempt. And cheerleaders, turns out, do not really have a problem with these, though not for the reasons you might think. That's This Week.
Saturday afternoon at 1 and Sunday evening at 6 on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for our salon. That's our beauty shop, barbershop hybrid, where we mix things up and dig into some pop culture stories with a diverse panel of men and women sitting in the chairs for a fresh cut or a new do. As it were, are Sarah Ventry, senior producer with public radio station KJZZ in Arizona. Bridget Armstrong is one of our Tell Me More producers and creator of the pop culture blog, BigAPicture.com. Trey Graham is a former NPR arts editor and an award-winning theater critic. And and Michael Arsenault is a writer and contributor to Complex.com and Ebony.com. Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
So let's start with a topic that's getting a lot of traction. Last week, Time published a piece by a young writer named Sierra Manny called Dear White Gays, Stop Stealing Black Female Culture. In the piece, Manny argues that some gay white men have appropriated black female culture, and she says, quote, maybe for some of you, it's a presumed mutual appreciation for Beyonce and Weaves that has you thinking that I'm going to be amused by you approaching me in your best Shaniqua from around the way voice. You are not a black woman, and you do not get to claim either blackness or womanhood, unquote. Now, the piece has gotten a lot of support and a lot of pushback, so I just wanted to ask each of you what you think about it. Bridget Armstrong, why don't you start?
Well, I will say I had a few issues with Manny's original piece. She kind of brought up some things about gay men not having to disclose their sexuality in a way that black women, you know, you see we're black, you can't. I'm not really with that. I think that's kind of an old mindset. But I had a lot of issue with some of the pushback pieces that were basically, you know, saying, because they don't like what Manny had to say, that she is wrong or it doesn't happen to her. And a lot of the people who wrote these pieces weren't people who have to deal with someone coming up saying, hey girl, hey sister, how you doing? In the kind of Shaniqua voice. And until that happens to you, and until you're put in a position where someone wants to talk to you about twerking because they've decided, oh, you're a black woman, that's what you're about, and so we're going to be best friends. Until you have to respond to that, I don't think you could kind of tear down her argument or her experience or invalidate it because you don't like it.
Trey Graham, what about you? You know, you were actually telling us that this is an old and painful argument. Talk a little bit more about that.
It is an argument that I've heard a lot over the years. There's a lot of validity to it. And I think you're absolutely right, Bridget, in that until you can acknowledge that this is painful in some ways, you can't get beyond the beginning of the conversation. One of my favorite responses was from Michelle Garcia, who's the managing editor of The Advocate magazine. And she's black, female, lesbian. And
The Advocate being a gay-oriented publication.
Yes, yes, mm-hmm. A gay news magazine. Mm-hmm. She points out that, you know, between the poles of outsider solidarity, in which, you know, gay men and black women have some experiences of being marginalized in common, even if they're not identical, and on the other end, the kind of oppression Olympics in which people say, no, I have it much worse than you, therefore, you know, you can't talk to me. There's a middle ground where, you know, a little mutual support might be welcome.
Mm. Was the piece useful in any way, Trey?
I think it was probably more useful to her original audience in her college newspaper.
Yeah, I think that was worth mentioning.
She's a
rising
college student.
Senior. She's a college student at the University of Mississippi.
Yes.
Majoring in classics and English. I'm quite impressed with that. So I thought I'd mention that. And she's a contributor to the opinion section of the school student newspaper, The Daily Mississippian. And that's where the article originally appeared. So thanks for pointing that out. But finish your thought.
I was just going to say that for a younger audience that may be just beginning to grapple with some of these issues, it's probably a welcome introduction to them. But I've seen a lot of really interesting, I don't want to say pushback, but reply. Especially, I have a lot of gay friends who are in interracial relationships, and the conversation on their Facebook pages has been very interesting.
Interesting. All right, maybe we'll have time to hear more about that. Sarah, what do you think? Sarah Ventry?
I guess I thought a lot about the kind of pushback and the kind of responses that she was getting and why they were so strong, because I feel like we've seen a lot of opinion pieces like this lately where people have these very strong responses, and inevitably some of the responses are, you know, that the person is unjustified in writing it or that it's not happening to them. And so for me, the kind of takeaway was just that, you know, teasing out the practicalities of this are very, very, very complicated. And it is, I think, very, very hard for a lot of people, particularly in the millennial generation, to recognize what kind of privilege we come to the table with. And so I felt like, as a white person, the takeaway for me was like that I need to be constantly challenging myself with my privilege and constantly understand what I am coming to society with an advantage in that maybe not everybody else is. And I think that that's an inherently uncomfortable thing to do, and it makes you have to step out of yourself a little bit. So I guess for me, I was thinking a lot about that and where this discomfort lies for a lot of people.
Well, just to go on, the piece isn't just about like Beyonce and weaves and like assuming that all Black women know how to twerk and want to teach you, but it's also about things like, you know, another paragraph in the piece says, you know, Black people can't have anything. Any of these things include, but aren't limited to, a general sense of physical safety, comfort with law enforcement, adequate funding and appreciation for Black spaces like schools and neighborhoods, appropriate venues for our voices to be heard about criticism of issues without our race going on trial because of it. Which was interesting because one of the responders to this piece that has also gotten a lot of attention was said, well, you know, a lot of y'all do talk like that, which is, I think, set off a lot of people, Michael, what about you?
I think, honestly, this is one of the situations where I feel like we could have had a really good discussion, but the teacher picked the wrong person in the class, so all hell broke loose. Respectfully, I understand that she's in college, but I felt like that was a deeply flawed piece, and that has to do a little bit with the editing. Because on one end, she's talking about appropriation and white gay men allegedly stealing white gay men stealing from Black female, but there aren't really specific examples. What I took away from the piece was that she has a problem with certain white men approaching her and being very stereotypical, which that is a legitimate complaint, and that's something to discuss. But, you know, as a gay Black man, I see gay Black male culture being, like, bitten all the time, and I kind of constantly talk about it. But I think ultimately the greater point about this whole appropriation argument that keeps going back and forth is that people want to be seen, and in her case, she just typically wants to be respected and, you know, be treated as an individual, which is fine, you know, because there are some white gay men who say, I think Perez Hilton said this a couple months ago on Twitter, that he is a Black woman, and, like, you know, there are certain white gay men that say that, and they think it's cute, but that's, you know, problematic. Particularly, there's a lot of frustration going around just in general, culturally and racially, but I just felt like it was a deeply flawed piece, and I just wish it kind of would have been tweaked more, because I think it's kind of one of those, like, tell them why you mad, son, subgenre of online literature now, where people kind of just rant, and doesn't really let you out. It's like, honestly, and there was a Time response piece on there from a white gay guy who said, white gay men as a group could be the truest friends Black women can have in American society. And that literally made me bust out laughing, because I'm like, based on what? Because, to be honest, a lot of white gay men don't include Black gay men. So what makes you think that they're, you know, they're going to be even better to you? And I think in his case, he needs to step out of his bubble. And in her case, I think she just kind of wants, again, to be respected. And there's a way to articulate that. But it just felt like she was very angry and kind of just like all over the place. And I don't know. Ultimately, Time Magazine trolled us because I kept getting sent every single article about this. So
it trolled
mission
you.
Accomplished.
Okay. Well, okay. See, now my Black woman hackles are rising on. She's so angry. Why is she so angry?
Well, I
anger
mean, she
is
sounds
an emotion
angry
which
in the
is
piece,
permitted.
Though.
I mean, people are allowed to be, you know.
Oh, I'm sure angry all the time. But I think ultimately you have to articulate your thoughts thoroughly. And I think in that piece, it was very flawed because it's kind of all over the place and didn't really live up to the title or the premise.
Okay, well, wait, just very, very briefly, do you think anything useful was accomplished by the piece, the publishing the piece? Did anything interesting or useful come out of that conversation, Michael?
No. I think sometimes just because something makes a lot of noise, it doesn't necessarily deserve that much attention. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't want to, like, knock her, but I just think I kind of wish someone had worked with her a little bit more in getting her thoughts out clearer. She has a right to be upset. I'm not trying to play into, like, why are you so mad? But you can tell there was anger in that piece, and only it just wasn't channeled clearly to me.
Okay. Well, speaking of, you were just saying that people just want to be seen. Well, it's kind of an awkward segue to our next topic, but this is about speaking of which, Holler If You Hear Me, the musical based on the lyrics of Tupac Shakur, is closing after just a month. It wasn't seen. Here's a clip if you miss it and if you don't have time to see it before its last performance, which is this Sunday.
Benny would still be over there alive if it weren't for you.
You're right. The system is locked. They got me trapped. My name's here, but this ain't me.
Once again, it's an all-out trap.
Keep your hands on your cat.
And your boy,
watch your back.
To catch in the alley, I tell ya, best of the best, said the best is gonna help ya.
Scream,
you hear me? See it clearly? Holler if you hear me.
Wait, What are you? Okay, all right. Oh, all right. Now you got to unpack this for me. But so there were high hopes for this production. It was directed by Kenny Leon, who's renowned for previous productions, including a revival of Raised in the Sun. It stars poet Saul Williams. Producers say the financial burdens of Broadway are forcing them to shut it down. Trey, as our theater critic here, I'm just thoughts about it.
There's
only the second
time
there's been a hip hop based musical.
Purely yes. I mean, if you go back to things like Bringing the Noise, Bringing the Funk, that was sort of inspired by hip hop, but sort of, you know, had this overlay of tap on top of it. But these things can be successful. In the Heights was a gigantic hit. Bringing the Noise, Bringing the Funk was a good show. It ran, it toured. I think this suffers from a lot of challenges that come from completely different angles, and it was probably snake bit from the start. The producers had no Broadway experience. They came in from Korea and the West Coast. They undercapitalized the show, if the reporting I've heard is correct. They only put up $8 million to keep it going. It was going to take more than that to let this show settle in and find an audience. I don't know that it was right for Broadway yet. A lot of these shows, Next to Normal, Spring Awakening, Passing Strange, start off Broadway.
Find
their footing, or in the regionals, find their footing, build an audience, build noise around them, and then they go to Broadway. This may have been too ambitious. I think it also might have suffered from the misapprehension that this was a biography of Tupac, which it is not. You were quite precise in saying it was inspired by Tupac's lyrics, not his life. It's a story. It's an original story about a block and the people who live on it and their ups and downs. And it mines Tupac's lyrics to tell that story.
Michael, you laughed when I mentioned this. And when I played the clip, what were you responding to there?
It just sounds so corny. God bless them. I mean, bless their hearts. But I just... I initially thought it was about Tupac. So I'm like, oh, okay, I might give it a shot. Then I just kept seeing the commercials and I read more about it. I was like, oh, I don't want to see this. I think in theory, you know, I'm getting older. Everyone, you know, there's already like an older initial hip hop generation. I think it'd be interesting to see a rap based Broadway show. But that ain't it. I just, no.
I was wondering why you hadn't seen it, because I was wondering if you hadn't. I know you live in New York, so it was easier for you than some. And so thanks for mentioning it. Bridget, you did see it. Thoughts about this?
I did see the play, and there's a lot of talk about, you know, whether Broadway was ready for hip-hop. It wasn't about hip-hop. It was this play in particular. It was not well done. It just wasn't good. A lot of the characters didn't really ring true. As Trey said, it was about, you know, the block and the hood and this gangster, and he wants to do better, but the hood won't let him. And in the end, we have to learn this lesson from his life that, you know, the black man has it bad. Like, that was the storyline. It was very flat. It was something you have seen before. None of the characters even felt like they'd been to the hood, let alone, you know, were of the hood. And I think
they went to the Magic Johnson Starbucks in the hood, sat there for a while.
And I think that a lot of it is, you know, the play can't be all things to all people. So you have your typical Broadway audience who may, you know, be like the kind of corny hip hop lyrics. And then you have people who are really into hip hop who are kind of offended. Like, this isn't authentic. What is this music? Why are they in conversation and bursting into rap songs? It just makes no sense. And so I think you have to pick one. You know, you have the people who are really into hip hop. Maybe it's geared towards them, or people who are just Broadway fans who may have an appreciation for it a little bit and geared towards them. But it can't be for both, because someone's going to be mad.
Sarah, before we let you go, I want to ask you about this too, because you're one, as a producer, you're one of the folks who has sometimes feels, I think I can say this, sometimes feels you have to fight for respect for the genre, even at this late stage, right? And so I'm just curious, what do you
the
have any
genre
thoughts?
Of musicals?
Hip-hop. Yeah, hip-hop. But no,
oh,
not
hip-hop.
Musicals. Hip-hop.
Yeah.
You know, just thought, do you have any brief thoughts about it? So,
yeah, my initial thought was, if Tupac is dead, he is rolling in his grave. Like, I was just, so full disclosure, I'm not a fan of musicals in general. It's very, very hard for me to sit down and watch one all the way through. But I guess I just felt like there was, I think what Bridget said makes a lot of sense. I think, you know, if you were going to do this, like, I don't know, I just thought there was nothing worse that you could do to Tupac's music than sterilize it. And I think Trey mentioned In the Heights, and I think from what I understand, one of the things that In the Heights was criticized for was kind of sterilizing the Heights, that it took this very difficult, very complicated, very neighborhood that was known for violence and then kind of sterilized it for a Broadway crowd. And so, I don't know that you can do that to Tupac and his music. I don't know that you can sterilize the sound and the story, make it generic, throw in a live orchestra, and then charge a couple hundred dollars for tickets. Like, it doesn't feel keeping in line with Tupac's music and message.
But just before we let you go on that, I do have to say, I had talked to Lin-Manuel Miranda about In the Heights, who's the creator of it, and he was very clear that, look, he grew up in that neighborhood and that people don't spend all day dodging bullets. And his attitude was, you know, we have relationships, we laugh, we have fun, we do other things.
Oh, absolutely.
So he was very clear that his intention was not to, that he felt there was enough of that and he didn't feel like he needed to have more of that, just to tie a bow on it. Not arguing
That's
with you, just
clear.
Adding other information.
Yeah.
Before we let you go, if you are one of the millions of Americans who've made football the most watched sport in America, then you will notice a change on the sidelines this year. Fox Sports reporter Pam Oliver is being replaced by Erin Andrews. Oliver is going to move to the network's number two announcing team. She'll be off the sidelines completely after this coming season. She doesn't seem to have been too happy about it, saying, you know, but Fox insists that Oliver will have an expanded role. Now, this has gotten a lot of attention because, you know, Oliver is 53 and African-American. Erin Andrews is white and in her 30s. And Sarah, you were saying briefly, if you would, that you're not surprised, even though you're not a huge sports fan either, but you weren't surprised. Thoughts about
right.
it?
Right. I'm not hugely surprised. I think that it does not take a lot of sports watching to know that the people who are on TV talking about sports who are women look a very particular way. And often they're very young and often they're white and often they're blonde and often they have big breasts. So I mean, this is a clear double standard, right? Like the men who are reporting on sports do not need to be sort of photogenic or you know, conventionally good looking in a way that women do in order to be on TV. So I was not surprised. It seems like obvious ageism.
Okay. Bridget Armstrong, final thought. You think Black Twitter might be to blame for this, for
Black
why?
Black Twitter said her hair looked like Chewbacca, and now she doesn't have a job.
Right, she had one bad hair day, and it made national news.
She had a bad hair life.
She had a bad hair life. You think that was responsible for this? Or you think that they took off hair for her hair?
I don't think Fox News even knows Black Twitter exists, or Fox Sports knows Black Twitter exists.
Michael, you
know,
think so?
Funny.
Michael, you think so?
I don't know. They don't care about us. I feel bad for her because that's one of those things, like, you're fixing a problem that didn't exist.
Well, she's very talented and she will be missed. Michael Arsenault is a writer and contributor to Complex.com and Ebony.com. He was with us from our bureau in New York. Sarah Ventry is a senior producer with the public radio station KJZZ in Arizona. She joined us from their studios in Tempe. Bridget Armstrong is a Tell Me More producer, creator of the blog BigAPicture.com. Trey Graham is a former NPR arts editor and award-winning theater critic. They were both with us in Washington, D.C. Thank you all so much.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to build a culture of health for all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. From the estate of Miles Gatterman, whose bequest is a tribute to NPR's ongoing dedication to music and the arts. From the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the passion of public radio listeners all across America who support their NPR member stations. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
The new book, Trans Bodies, Trans Selves, is a resource manual for the transgender community inspired by the feminist health manual, Our Bodies, Ourselves. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the editor, and two of the contributors talk about their experiences transitioning to the gender they identified with. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Next time on NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia, we'll revisit some of our more crafty and sneaky games in our really hard edition.
The Great Gatsby Beetle Bailey?
Yes!
Yes!
I don't get it.
Join me, Ophir Eisenberg, for NPR's guiltiest and most puzzling pleasure, Ask Me Another.
Saturday morning at 11 on AM 580.
Support comes from the Prairie Ensemble, presenting its farewell concert, a musical soiree, on Saturday, July 19th at Faith United Methodist Church in Champaign. On the program, Beethoven's Symphony No. 6 and the Flute Concerto by Carl Nielsen, featuring longtime principal flutist Mary Leathers Chapman. Concert begins at 7:30 with a concert conversation at 7.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Nearly 2 years ago, Malala Yousafzai was shot in the head by a Taliban extremist in her home at Pakistan's Swat Valley. It was retribution for her outspokenness about the importance of girls' education. Since then, against all odds, Malala has made a miraculous recovery, and she's become a global icon. She recently turned 17 years old, and she made public her birthday wish. It's to bring back hundreds of schoolgirls abducted by Islamic militants 3 months ago. She's in Nigeria this week to put pressure on the government. Here's a clip of her speaking to the BBC.
When I met the parents, they all were crying, and they were asking the government, they were asking their president that they should bring back our girls. So it's a message of everyone here in Nigeria that their girls should be freed as soon as possible, because those girls have the right to get education and they are human beings. They deserve the right to be, not to be forced and not to be kidnapped. They deserve to be free and they deserve to be treated with equality and justice.
We thought this would be a good time to hear again from this remarkable young woman by revisiting a conversation I had with Malala and her father, Ziauddin Yousafzai. They were on a visit to Washington last October. She started by telling me what she admired most about her father.
He's a great father, and I am inspired by him because the work he was doing at that time when terrorism was spreading in Swat, it was really hard to speak at that time, and my father did. And I got inspired by him, and that's why I said that I will also speak up for my rights, and I'll also speak up for the rights of every girl to get education and to go to school.
Ziauddin, what do you most admire about Malala?
It's a difficult question.
Thank you very much.
I think Malala is an average girl, but there are something which is extraordinary about her. She never agrees with me. And one special quality which she has, that she doesn't commit a mistake again. So she doesn't repeat her mistakes. And she's very respectful to her teachers, to her elders. And she's a good girl. I love
you. I do want to ask you, Ziauddin, what it does start with you. What you ran a girls' school that, Malala, you attended. And I have to ask, what gave you this passion for girls' education? Because I think that it's one thing when you are the person who is on the bottom to want to rise, but it's another when you are on the top and to want to share the privileges that you had as a man and as the head of a household. So where did you get your passion for girls' education?
Basically, I was born in a society where girls are ignored. Right from the very beginning, I was very sensitive to this kind of discrimination. And I think that this simple biological difference between the men and women should not be the base of the political and social discrimination. I'm asked often that, what special training have you given to your daughter? So I usually tell people, you should not ask me what I have done, rather you ask me what I did not do, which is usually done by parents. I did not clip her wings to fly. I did not stop her from flying. And I always give a message to the parents all around the world where girls are suffering, that trust your daughters, they are faithful. Honor your daughters, they are honorable, and educate your daughters, they are amazing.
Malala, one of the things that I have heard you say which has not gotten a lot of attention, in fact, you said this at the United Nations when you spoke there, is that you are not just fighting for the rights of girls to get education, you are also fighting for the rights of boys to get education, including the children of the terrorists. And I'd like to ask you to tell us more about that. Why do you feel that way?
There has been a discrimination in our society, and men have been doing this for centuries. But this time, we women are going to bring change. We are speaking up for girls' rights, but we must not behave like men. We must not behave like they have done in the past. We must believe in equality, and we must take each decision with justice. But we also speak about boys' rights, because in many countries, they cannot go to school because of child labor. Their only job is to earn. So I think we also need to speak up for them.
See, one of the other things that I'm not sure that everyone fully understands is that your family was under threat for a very long time. This is not something that happened in a day or a week. It was really years that you feared for your safety and for your family's safety, that you were being threatened for a very, very long time. And I think a lot of people would be interested to know how you sustained yourself through that period. How did you keep going?
Yes, of course. I was on Taliban's radar for the last 3-4 years, I can say. This was not only me, because hundreds of opinion leaders, hundreds of elders, they have been assassinated. And I was one of them. And I took care in my own way, but I didn't have any security. But one has to live. I mean, there is no option. When she was targeted just 10 months before, when she got famed that very year in 2012, they issued a warning that as she is speaking against us, and we will not tolerate it. But we thought that even terrorists might have some ethics, because they destroyed some 1,500 schools, but they never injured a child. And she was a child.
Malala, do you mind if I ask, do you think you're making a difference?
When I look at the response of people, when I look at the love and the support of people, then I think a day will come that we will see every child to go to school. Most of the time I'm related to the Taliban, but I want education. And when I talk about education, there are many issues as well. Children are suffering from child labor. They have to earn for their family. They're being used for earning money by some robbers. So there are many difficulties for children to go to school, not only terrorism.
Forgive me for making a joke, but speaking of child labor, you're working very hard these days. I mean, I understand they have you going from like pillar to post and from place to place. You've been on quite a tour. Are you having any fun at all?
It's a very nice question. Well, I miss those days, but...
Dad?
No, Dad is fine. Dad is quite good. First thing is that outside of my home, I look like a very obedient, a very serious, a very good kind of girl. But nobody knows what happens inside the house. So, inside the house, I was quite, well, it does not mean that I was naughty. My brothers used to fight with me, and then I had to give them a response.
Well, so of course. I mean, of course.
So that's why it's good to fight with your brothers, and it's good to teach them, to give them advices. And my little brother, he's 9 years old, and I fight with him because I'm thinking about his future.
Okay.
He wants iPad, he wants iPod,
He wants to play games, and I think that is not good for his future. And in response, he cries and he shouts to me, and he says, "You can forgive the Taliban, but you are not forgiving me."
What did he say to you? "Why are you so famous?" he said.
They also don't know what I do. We both were sitting on a table and we were having breakfast. So he said, "Malala." I said, "Yes." "I can't understand why people are giving you prizes. And everywhere you go, people say, like, this is Malala, and they give you a award. What have you done?" So he still needs to understand.
You're just my annoying sister. Do you want to go back home?
Yes, of course, because how can one forget his home? And I love Pakistan, and I miss Pakistan. And I'm hopeful that I will go back to Pakistan as soon as possible. But first, I need to empower myself with knowledge, with education. I need to work hard. And when I would be powerful, then I'll go back to Pakistan, inshallah.
See you, Undeen. Do you think that might be possible? Do you want to go home too? Do you think you will be able to?
It's a difficult question. These days, I think, quite dangerous for me as well as for her. So we will go back. I'm needed in Pakistan. I'm needed in Afghanistan. I'm needed in Swat. I should contribute to girls' education, to boys' education. And I believe that one should live for a cause which is greater than him. Even if I die, I will continue my campaign, but I will not put her life at stake. That's clear.
The Taliban say they would still like to kill her. They would still like to
kill her. She will answer it.
I have already seen death, and I know that death is supporting me in my cause of education. Death does not want to kill me. Before this attack, I might have been a little bit afraid how death would be. Now I'm not, because I have experienced it. So they cannot make me stop to continue my campaign.
Sia Uddin, do you have hope that groups like the Taliban can be brought into dialogue with people, that their reign of terror will end?
Yes, I have hope. Mm-hmm. And to speak honestly, mm-hmm. it needs a political will. We must put pressure on our governments. I should put pressure on my government, on my state. You should put pressure on your state. That why a huge amount of the taxpayers is spent on arms and munitions. Why? And that was what she said. I will quote my daughter. She should quote me, by the way, but I will quote her.
Well,
that send pins, not guns. Send books, not tanks. And the most beautiful thing, send teachers, not soldiers. Thank you.
I spoke with Malala and Zia Uddin Yousafzai in front of an audience when they visited Washington, D.C. in October last year. And finally, as you may have heard, our last broadcast is scheduled for August 1st. So as we wind down production, we thought it would be nice to hear what members of our staff are listening to as part of our regular series, In Your Ear. As a producer and our current director, Andrew Limbong is responsible for a lot of the music you hear every day on this program. So we wondered, what's on his playlist?
Hey, I'm Andrew. I'm a producer and director here at Tell Me More. The first song that's playing in my ear is Fresh Attitude, Young Body by Bomb the Music Industry. Dust, a great Brooklyn sky, a train that I'm missing, a cheap travel mug that leaks from the side, damp coat and mittens. If you don't find a steady job now, if you don't find a steady job now. They're like a DIY punk band out of Brooklyn, and it's a song about being sad and bummed out that nothing's working out really. But it's really happy because there's like hand claps and dancing and, you know, mixing happy music and just being bluntly sad. I mean, one of the lines in the song is just like, "I'm so sad."
because I'm going to die alone and my parents will have to pay my medical bills. It's like, oh, but like, hey, and it's a lot of that stuff going on. So, I don't know, it kind of reminds me that, oh, if things are down and you're feeling lonely or whatever, you can at least play power chords in your bedroom and jump around and say, hey. Another song that's playing in my ear is Up Around the Bend by Creedence Clearwater Revival. When I was growing up, my dad and I didn't really agree on a lot of things, except that the classic rock station ruled. There's a place up ahead and I'm going, just as fast as my feet can fly. Come away if you're going, leave the sinking ship behind. Come on the rising wind, we're going up around the bend. Ooh. Whenever Creedence played, he'd get really quiet and be like, you know, when I stowed away on the ship to get to America, they played a lot of Creedence Clearwater Revival. And I was like, oh man, that's so cool. Come on the rising wind, we're going up around the bend. I don't even know if that's true, like as an adult, but I really don't care. So I imagine like my dad in a box of some sort and just like, oh man, John Fogerty's voice is keeping me alive and getting there. So, yeah, thanks John Fogerty for keeping up the spirit. This is a wall we can learn. After 10,000 years, it's still us against them, and my heroes have always died at the end. So who's going to account for these sins? Another song that's playing in my ear is called 4 Score and 7. It's by a New Jersey band called Titus Andronicus. The final lyrics, it's still us against them, and it repeats that over again. Still us against them, still us against them. When you're in the pit with like a bunch of sweaty dudes and you're shouting that together, and like there are strangers that I've hugged and like kissed on the cheek because it's like, hey man, it is us against them. They are awful, whoever they may be. But you and me, we're in this together. And for, you know, that 2 seconds that we're holding each other, it's like we're best friends all of a sudden.
That was Tell Me More producer and director Andrew Limbong telling us what's playing in his ear. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.